Welcome back to Inside Track. Bruce and Eb here, broadcasting from the Perfection Auto Works studio today. Bruce and I remind you to support all our great Inside Track sponsors. Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management.
That's him.
Woohoo! Eric Rudin at Essential Pest, Jamie Kipper at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, and Mike Emery from Perfection Auto Works. We support each one of these locally owned run businesses. So should you. Our special Veterans Day guest for the next several minutes is retired U.S. Army warfighter Willis Lee. Lieutenant Colonel Willis Lee is a combat vet, graduate of West Point, a 22-year Ranger, an airborne qualified Army officer, and was awarded the Defense Superior Service Medal and Bronze Star Medal. Colonel Lee served our nation with duty from the Cold War in Europe to counterterrorism to Desert Storm in Iraq, to nuclear operations at the Pentagon Joint Chiefs of Staff. Willis is a member of the National Rifle Association of America Board of Directors and is the immediate past first vice president of the NRA. He's a trustee of the NRA Foundation and an NRA certified firearms instructor. Willis is a member of the Council for National Policy, former president of the National Federation of Republican Assemblies, a former RNC member and GOP state chairman, and served for a number of years on the American Conservative Union Foundation Board, which hosts CPAC. Willis, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Eb, Bruce. Thanks for having me on today.
I don't think we've ever done as long of an introduction for any of our guests in the 7 years we've been doing the show.
Well, not a lot of people have his qualifications.
Exactly. That's my point.
Or write them down, which you should. And Willis, thank you for being here. Tell us about your personal story entering military service.
Well, that bio just about wraps up my career there. Look, Veterans Day is so much easier on a soldier, sailor, Marine, Eb, like you, or an airman than Memorial Day is. So I appreciate you guys airing your tributes today with the Inside Track listeners. I got to start, though. Duke basketball lost at home to Arizona last night.
Yes, they did.
Before coming on today. But by O-Dark 30 this morning, I was already receiving emails from guys I went to combat with. And it's always about the people. That's what it's been about. That's what it'll always be about. As you guys know, many Americans don't, or they won't serve the nation. Less than 1% serve in the military. On the other hand, most can't meet the physical and mental and psychological standards. So only 1% of us are privileged to serve in the military. So that's where I'd like to start from today and then take it from there.
So military service in your family past?
Yeah, I have. You know, God puts you exactly where you're supposed to be. I am from a military family. My father served 50 years of active duty in National Guard through World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. We buried him at 103 years old with full military honors just this summer in Arlington National Cemetery. I have an older brother who did 38 years in the Special Forces with three tours in Vietnam. The next brother did 32 years after West Point. He was in military intelligence during the Cold War and two tours in Vietnam. Every one of them was a better soldier than I was. So bottom line is I grew up in Europe as we traveled around the world in France and Germany on military bases with military family and military friends and a military life. And from that, it was very competitive to get into West Point, and it's very competitive to stay.
So as a fellow vet, what meaning does Veterans Day have for you?
You know, this is an exciting time because so much of America has forgotten just what those people who stand on the wall do for them. So Veterans Day for us gives an opportunity for effectively the rest of America to appreciate those folks standing on the wall for them. And especially now, you know, we've been at war for the last 20 years. Looks like we're going to go into more. The veterans, even more so than Eb, your time, my time, we owe these veterans now a great debt.
I always make sure when I see somebody who's a vet, I thank them for their service. When I see somebody who is a Vietnam vet, I always say, welcome home.
Oh, yeah. No, exceptional. Exceptional. I'll tell you, we also have some background that a lot of people don't get. In the military, it's not just a learning experience, but the leadership opportunities that you get. Let me run through some of this. You mentioned some of my bio. Ultimate responsibilities at a young age that you won't find in many 20-year-olds now. The first death I experienced was an hour into my first training exercise in Germany. In the military, when you're in command of a Marine platoon or a tank company, it's total responsibility for your soldiers, from everything from combat readiness to making sure they're paying their bills on time. So at 23 years old, by the time I was 25 years old, I already had command of 120 soldiers, 38 tanks and combat vehicles, about $30 million worth of equipment. And on the border between freedom and communism in the Cold War, when we thought the Soviets would come across the border, our life expectancy was 28 seconds. That's pretty heady stuff that you don't see young people getting into these days.
Yeah, I started off in field artillery, and the same type of thing. You know, you never realize, you know, looking back now, it's like, crap, I can't believe I was in charge of that at that young of an age. And you look at 21, 22, 23-year-olds now that can barely run a McDonald's because they can't read.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. Now, I will tell you, the folks we have serving now, the young men and women, they're great. They're absolutely great. I do have my issues, and you guys, we've talked about it with the leadership at Department of Defense, Army, Navy, Marines. Well, not so much Marines. Army, Navy, Air Force.
Well, but, yeah, you guys can read.
But the soldiers, the sailors, the airmen, the Marines, these guys are great. And they do things that I could never do even at that age. They are so smart, so quick, so strong. So I appreciate those young men and women standing on the wall today.
Yeah, the technology out there in the military today is so much more than anything you and I ever had.
No, absolutely. Warfare has changed, but all the aspects have. I chased terrorists for a while across Europe and Africa. This is like the Baader-Meinhof guys, Red Brigades, the Red Army faction. Terrorism is different these days. Narco-terrorism is different these days. An open border down south. Everything's changed in our world in the way we fight wars. Now you have the aspect of overhead munitions and drones watching every move that you make. GPS that can track everybody everywhere on the battlefield. It is a different battlefield out there now.
So Willis, you went to the military academy.
Yes.
Tell me about that. What prompted you to wake up and say, I think I'm going to go to West Point?
You know, coming from a military family, it was just, for me, it was just destined. I never thought otherwise. I told a friend the other day, at that point in my life, now I'm 16, 17 years old, I was going to go one of two ways. So I applied to the West Point, the military academy, and I applied to the University of Hawaii. I was either going to go to the Army, be disciplined, defend the nation, or I was going to go to the University of Hawaii, maybe drop out, surf the rest of my life. And that decision pretty much set me on a track for the rest of my life. And then once you get into it, as I said, there's something about defending the nation. There's a pride and honor in doing so. You never get rich, but what you get is a wealth of people in your life that you served with, that you've gone to combat with, that stay with you forever.
Why were you selected to go to West Point? How did that happen?
Interesting. There's several ways to get in. One of the most difficult things is because it is very competitive to get in. You not only have to meet all the physical, mental, psychological standards, and at that age, there are a lot of young people, especially these days, who can't meet simply the physical standards of going in. However, like a lot of us, I'd been an athlete in high school. That was the easy part. But then you have to be nominated either by one of your congressmen, that is senator or congressman, or a presidential nomination. There are others that can go in directly from the Army to go to West Point. But so it's a very limited pool, and even that's competitive. Congressmen, as you can imagine, keep a tally sheet. And when they nominate somebody, I think it's they get to nominate to each academy each year several young men or women. They keep a tally sheet on them on how many get accepted, how many actually graduate, and they get graded that way. I was fortunate that my brother had already gone. So in family history, at least it's a good bet for somebody nominating me that it's a good chance that the guy's going to get in, the guy's going to graduate. So I had that going for me. So I appreciated that.
Did you have good grades in high school? You mentioned that you were athletic. What did grades and and your athletic achievements and maybe your family history contribute to you being able to get into the service academy?
But not so much family history back then. I know they've made some changes these days where they're trying to become more diversified and all this kind of stuff as opposed to just taking the best candidates. But the grades are absolutely important. That is interesting, though. You don't have to do it through private schools. Mine was all public school education through the Department of Defense in Europe and then through the Virginia public schools with a focus on mathematics and sciences. Back then, and this has changed 20 years ago, back then, the academies were engineering schools. Now you can get there's a myriad of degrees that one can get, including in the arts. But we were all engineers coming out of West Point. So having that background in math and sciences was very important.
I bet you that helped athletic. As an artillery officer, as an armor guy.
Yes, it absolutely does, and understanding the academics of it, but there's also a discipline to it. There's a right and wrong to it. There's a process to solve problems, and all of that helps. And then athletics, I tell you, you show up at a place like West Point or the Naval Academy or Air Force, everyone was the captain of their whatever athletic team in school. Everyone was a standout in school. It's a great group of young men and women that we recruit to get into the academies.
So you went into the academy, what, 1982?
I got there in 73.
Oh, 73.
Which was just an interesting time. For your listeners who don't know me, my family is from Hawaii. So Japanese on my mother's side, Filipino, Portuguese on my father's side. But I have this look, a little bit of an Asian look. Now, Vietnam is just ending. So I'm going to Beast Barracks with seniors who have had brothers, fathers, friends over in Vietnam getting shot at. And that all played into the hazing of Beast Barracks, of which I thought was interesting and just added another dimension to being there in 73. Graduated in 77 and then went straight to Germany for my first assignment on the border of Czechoslovakia facing the Soviets.
So when you went in, did you expect that you would go into combat?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, this is not, and Ev, you understand this from your time, it's not something that you want to do, but this is something that we're trained to do, we're prepared to do, that we're expected to do. So absolutely, and during the Cold War, that entire time, we were mobilized on the border. I fully expected and felt like we were in a combat situation. Several times in my career that way, chasing some terrorists sometimes in Europe and Africa, more so than later on in my career I did that, but it was more an operational aspect. And then certainly Desert Storm was, I came out of command in General Staff College as a major at the time, got to Fort Stewart, Georgia. And a week later happened to be the guy in the operations office that received the call we were deploying for Desert Storm and Desert Shield and Desert Storm. So that was an expectation then that we would see combat. Nothing like what happened after 9/11, when some of my younger friends have been in combat, in war, for the last two decades. It's just been an amazing pace for these guys since I got out.
Yeah, when I went in, it was 81. I received my commission in 83. So I was in during the greatest peacetime. Because of me, the world was free for the entire time
I was
in. That's
quite an accomplishment.
It was. I did a great job. But,
good job.
But, you know, we lost friends in the Beirut bombing in 83.
A lot of them.
Yeah, it was terrible. We got a caller, Gary from Bisbee. He's got a question. Gary, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Lee, I was listening to you. You mentioned how the youth are not enlisting because they see the services are compromised with being woke and gender-focused. Do you think West Point is clear of this, or are they getting that similar problem?
Hey, Gary, thanks for calling in. First, on your premise, I don't think that's quite what I said. It was more to the point. I have issues with the DOD leadership. But I have in other places discussed this issue of a lot a focus on DEI and CRT in the military now as opposed to warfighting. I'll go again to say it's the leadership pushing this down. It's not the soldiers, sailors, and airmen and Marines pushing this up. Those young people are great people. They're prepared. They're ready for what we need them to do to stand on the wall. But absolutely, I think at the top levels, and this flows from the Biden administration, I believe that we're focusing not enough on warfighting and too much on social programs.
Gary, any other questions for Willis?
Mr. Willis, thank you for serving our country, and God bless.
Thanks, Gary.
Willis, on this Veterans Day 2023, if you're sitting down having a beer with some of your U.S. Army comrades, what's your mood and what's their mood about the current condition of our nation, given the service that you've all had to defend the homeland?
Yeah, thanks. I'll tell you, we don't get together that often. We're all spread across the nation. We're around the world. But when we do, we tip a beer to the guys who aren't here now. That's the first thing that we think
Amen,
about.
Amen, brother.
Is the fact that we still are, and for the most part, same thing. I've been through, and you too have been through all of these training and combat. It doesn't matter. It is always what we do is always dangerous. And the fact that we're together, we're alive, we've got our arms and our legs, that's a blessing. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
My squadron in the Marine Corps, we lost more people in training than we did in combat. And during Desert Storm, the two that we did lost were taken prisoner and then returned. So nobody died, but we had a lot of people die during training.
Yeah, absolutely. And so for the young men and women serving now, it is so crucial. We're at such a point now, and it's not just the wars that we see in Ukraine and Gaza and the possibility of that getting more widespread, just the violent crime in the cities and open border to our south. And I pray for those young men and women, but I'll tell you, and we know this on this call, your listeners know this, this is a family affair. The families that are involved in that, and if it's a young man or woman, their parents are involved in that service. Their wives, their sons, their daughters are all involved in this when anybody enlists and serves the nation. So hats off to them, and my prayers go out to them.
Hey, with that being said, Newsweek just reported a dramatic drop in military recruitment and opined that young Americans don't want to defend our country. I can tell from experience, my stepson just finished a tour as a Marine recruiter in Las Vegas, and he had a very hard time finding people that, A, wanted to serve, and B, were qualified physically as well as, you know, not doing drugs or not having a criminal background. What's your thoughts on all that?
I'm seeing the same thing out there, and I'm hearing the same thing. And the scariest part is whether or not the services are going to have to lower the standards. I know they're already making accommodations for making unit size smaller or doing away with some units. But the bottom line is, we're going to have to, in some way, manage to keep our strength, our manpower up. I would totally separate debate on whether we ought to reinstitute the draft.
Yes.
And start having a draft. But we're going to have a whole nother segment or a whole nother radio show on that.
I agree. How would you feel if one of your kids wanted to follow into military service?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's important, and it might not be military service, but service to the nation, I think, is absolutely critical. Everybody should do that. I guess this touches on the idea of a draft. I think you want to be there. I want you to be there. I don't want a guy on my left or right who doesn't want to be there in the first place. But to have a son, or in my case, I have two, albeit they're overage now, out of the age limit to enlist. There's an honor, there's a pride in serving the nation, and it's important. As I said, you're never going to get wealthy doing this, but you get wealthy in a lot of other ways, just knowing that you've done your duty for the nation.
I heard that the Army just raised their maximum age to 42 for enlistment.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, especially these days. We're all living longer. We're all stronger. I feel very healthy now. Not that I could do what a 42 or certainly a 20-year-old could do, but there are certainly roles that all these folks could play, especially if they've got if they have experience. The most important thing, especially at that point, is the leadership aspect. There's not a lot of people who are prepared to lead. There's not a lot of people who accept the responsibility of leadership. So I don't expect 42-year-olds to be serving in an infantry squad, but I do believe that there's a lot of positions they can fulfill.
Well, it's ready to go to break in just a couple of minutes, and you've kindly agreed to stay on after the break, and we appreciate that. I just want to share with you an experience in my own life. My father-in-law served in the Super Sixth Armor Group in World War II. They landed in Brest, France, and he was wounded about day 45 into his warrior days, and pretty seriously wounded. He was in a hospital convalescing for over 13 months when he did return to the United States and lived with a disability for the rest of his life. And I asked him one day, he was 96 at the time, I said, "When you fought in World War II, Poppy, were you fighting to help save democracy?" He looked at me, you know, kind of side glanced to me, and our two sons were there as well. And he said, "Bruce, that didn't make any difference to any of us. We were fighting to live another day. When you were fighting, was it the same story, fighting to live another day?"
Yeah, Bruce, interesting. S.F.A. Marshall actually did a study, the great historian did a study on this, and generally we enlist because of service to the nation, our duty to stand on that wall for the nation. But when you get in a fight, when you're actually being shot at and shooting back, it's all about the guy on your left, or guy yeah. or gal on your left and right. That's what it's about, yeah. And you want to protect them just like they want to protect you.
Well, obviously things haven't changed very much because about 50 years later, when they had their reunion, a lot of his friends, when he left the battlefield, they thought he had died. And when they saw him, they were amazed that this guy was still alive lived to tell the story. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break for some commercial messages. We're going to come back with Willis Lee, continue talking about this Veterans Day, and maybe a couple of other issues of interest to all of you. Please stay tuned. No channel flipping. We'll be right back.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
It's fall 1621, and the pilgrims are readying their crops, but in the turkey barn, trouble is brewing.
We cannot stand for this injustice. All turkeys are equal. Just some of us are more equal than others. We shall not end up on a dinner table. We will escape.
Oh no, we must capture those turkeys.
I can fix that, Governor. I'm an auto mechanic.
Eustace Emery, mechanic? Strange no one's invented the automobile yet. Oh well, if you can capture the turkeys, do it.
And so Thanksgiving was saved because Eustace Emery invented the Plymouth Arrow and recaptured the turkeys.
Perfection Auto Works, 1046 North Beverly, 323-8650. Or perfectionautoworks.com. 323-8650.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then failed to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's 777-1911. Welcome back to Inside Track, brought to you in the Perfection Auto Works studio by Essential Pest, Wilkinson Wealth Management, and the aforementioned Perfection Auto Works. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Willis Lee is going to stay with us for a few more minutes. Willis is a national NRA board member, along with me. There's been talk since October that American Jews who feel threatened by Hamas terror, possibly impacting them and their families, are buying firearms. If a Jewish friend of yours was nervous after the 10/7 attacks, what advice would you give them?
Willis?
Hello, Willis.
Sorry about that. Hey, let me finish up this last segment. Hats off to the two of you for spending time this weekend to highlight veterans for Veterans Day. It is difficult for a lot of veterans, and I appreciate you doing that. After October 7th, the terror attacks in Israel, the world changed, and as it should, just like it did for us and the world after 9/11. Bruce, my condolences and prayers. You must be deeply affected by this. In the U.S., we've had 51 months straight of 1 million plus firearms being purchased, but the number was dropping close to 1 million. After Hamas started this war against women and children and civilians, that number jumped back near 1.5 million last month.
Wow.
And across the U.S., watching these pro-Hamas protests and threats and vandalism and attacks, some violent, got a lot of folks' attention. So it's not just the Jewish community, but especially members of the Jewish community. Many are first-time firearms purchasers. Many vote or used to vote for Democrats controlling guns. Now they're seeing the need to defend their family. And in some states run by Democrats, they're finding out how difficult, time-consuming, and costly it is to exercise their Second Amendment rights. But this has added a different dimension here in America, where we're all feeling a little less safe than we were before October 7th.
So I think I know the answer to this question, Willis. But if you had a friend who suddenly, they were not a gun person before, and were either ambivalent or was not heavily in support of the Second Amendment, now they say, hey, I think I need to protect myself and my family. What would your advice, the first piece of advice to that person be about how to arm themselves and what to do if they did want to arm themselves?
Easily. Right now, head to wherever your closest firearms store is. There's a lot of folks there that have experience and can give you some information to get you started. Look, whether you're new or experienced, I highly recommend training and practice. You know, once you determine the firearm, and it's not just you go just buy something off the shelf. It depends on how you're going to use it, where you're going to use it, where you're going to store it. But like anything we do, training and practice makes it better at that activity. And then this is similar, not the same, but it's sort of like CPR. You don't want to ever have to use it. But if you do, then you better know how, and you better be good.
And to prevent injury to yourself using the firearm as well, right?
Absolutely. And that's the first thing that the NRA and all the organizations that teach firearms, firearm safety. That is the first aspect of everything we do. And there's several good organizations that provide training. The easiest for me here in this time frame to point out is for people to go to NRA.org, find an instructor near you. The NRA is the gold standard of basic firearms training. That's just the basic for pistol, rifle, shotgun, and it's accepted by law enforcement and government. There's more training you can get on top of that, but you first get your basic training and then learn safety. The NRA's got 125,000 certified instructors across the nation, so there's someone near you. We already train more than 1 million Americans each year. Those numbers are increasing since October 7th, and it's important that not only do you go out and have a firearm to defend you and your family, but that you get trained in the proper use and know the safety.
And you've served at the highest levels of the National Rifle Association. And probably one of the major aspects of your service has been with respect to firearms training and safety, hasn't it? Because this is really at the groundwork for anybody who wants to be able to exercise their Second Amendment rights and provide basic protection to themselves and their family, right?
Well, it's crucial, and it is for the Second Amendment, but it is now becoming more and more true that we have to be able to protect ourselves with this rampant crime that we see in the cities, but right. moving out into the suburbs, knowing that the borders are open and we don't know who's coming across our borders, and then seeing these wars now, since Biden took over, popping up all around the world. So it's more important than ever, but you're absolutely right. The first and most important aspect is firearm safety, not just for you, but your family and anyone who may be near that firearm, but then being able to know how to use it.
Willis, a couple of years ago, there were several places that one could not go out and buy a firearm for self-protection because of the local governmental regulations. Now, we had some Supreme Court cases that have changed that. Can you talk about that and how that changed?
Yeah, the NRA won a big case just last year, last June. It was the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. And the Supreme Court, now, mind you, the Second Amendment doesn't give us a right to defend ourselves. The Second Amendment affirms the God-given right to defend ourselves. And the Supreme Court mentioned that again in the Bruin case. Now, since then, though, there are some states and localities that are pushing back and don't necessarily make it easy for someone to exercise their Second Amendment rights. And I'll give you an example of California, New York, places like Chicago. So it's important now that we have those rights and we can carry a firearm to defend ourselves that we do so. There are three Supreme Court cases that are brought up this session that are going to be adjudicated. And we'll find out if our Second Amendment rights expand or get reduced again.
So let's talk about those cases. Willis, if you would, that are before SCOTUS in this session.
Boy, let me go. I'm just going to give a synopsis because there's three of them, and some of this will have to expand on this. The first one, we just heard oral arguments last Tuesday, Rahimi. It's centered on restricting Second Amendment rights for people with a TRO, a temporary restraining order. But it has to do a lot with due process. It's complicated because Rahimi himself is allegedly a domestic abuser who's on several occasions misused firearms. So that we're trying to keep centered on due process. Cargill is a bump stock case. And right. it's not really about bump stocks and turning and use of those with a firearm. That's more about unelected deep state bureaucrats, in this case at the ATF, making up laws instead of Congress doing so. So that's about government overreach more so than bump stocks. And finally, is a great case that the NRA has now. It's actually a First Amendment case, not a Second Amendment case, brought against the state of New York, who a New York official threatened bank and insurance agencies that if they did business with the NRA or Second Amendment organizations, that, you know, something might happen to you. It's one of those where, wow, wouldn't that be strange if you got audited all of a sudden? So facetiously, it comes down to mean whether New York was really mean or just a little mean. But the underlying issue is the weaponization of government right now.
But isn't that on this weaponization aspect? This has been going on against the NRA in New York State for years, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just against the NRA, but against firearms owners, the Second Amendment. And otherwise, it is a case and it is politicized. A lot of us at NRA have been deposed several times. We have a major lawsuit coming up in January that the New York AG has brought, the Attorney General has brought against the NRA. So that's a constant fight. Meanwhile, that's about politics. We have some real world issues here, as we've talked about here, with an open border, with wars in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, with crime in our cities, that we need to be able to protect ourselves and our families.
Willis, before we close, because I don't want to keep you too long, it's getting to be kind of late back east where you're at, I think. Just a message for our listeners, other veterans who might hear your voice about service and about remembering those who have served our country so honorably over the decades and the centuries.
Well, I'll kick it out, and for now I'm in politics. And Bruce, when I got into politics, you were my mentor when I joined the RNC, and I appreciate that. But let me end it with this. We don't give enough props nor support to the guys and gals who have stood on the wall the last 20 years, and looks like it's going to be more. when you hear stories of an incompetent Veterans Administration or vets being kicked out of housing to make room for illegal immigrants or vets who are homeless, it's disgusting. So for everyone out there, this is a great Veterans Day. I appreciate all the tributes to veterans, but take care of those veterans. Remember why they're here, why we can do what we do, because they stood on the wall for us.
Thank you, Willis. Thanks for your service to our country, both in uniform and also in politics, and sticking up for our Second Amendment rights. You are one of the truly great Americans. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family, and we'll talk again soon.
God bless. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Willis.
You bet. Wow. Willis really, you know, Eb and I have known Willis for years. Willis, when he served at the RNC, was one of the bravest members that we had. He said something nice about me for a second. Willis, I didn't teach Willis a damn thing. Willis's leadership, Willis understanding the difference between what was right and wrong, what was smart and was not smart, and he was never afraid to express himself. And the way that he was treated within the Republican Party, the official party, as well as by others, it didn't deter him at all.
And once again, I say that comes down to the training and education of the United States Armed Forces.
Well, and look at his family history as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's between him and his brothers and his father, there's almost 200 years of military service just in the family. He just buried his father last summer at 103.
And how the heck did he get 50 years of service? God bless him for that.
I don't know how that could happen. But God bless him for being able to do it. He's truly an amazing individual, and Willis works. This is not just an avocation for him. I mean, this is what
he works tirelessly
every single day, just he gives an enormous amount of his heart and his soul and his brain to what we need here in America. So we have a few minutes left before we sign off for today. I want to talk for a second about freeing Gaza. We've seen a lot of people this week with these big Free Gaza signs.
Right, so we're getting back to what we were talking about before.
Yeah. And no, Gaza isn't being given away for free, okay? It's not on bargain sale at Kmart, okay? People holding placards that say Free Gaza. And I'll preface by saying they have no idea what they're talking about because they've been brainwashed and indoctrinated by college professors, and these are some of the same hippies that we knew in college are now running colleges and universities around the country,
and they're even bigger hippies.
And so they say free Gaza. Okay, Gaza's been free since 2005. Gaza was free long before then as well. It was only after a significant terror activity took place in that Gaza Strip, as they call it, that the Israelis came in to take civil control of that region. What's amazing is nobody understands that Israel has been out of there. Fatah won an election in 2005 or 2006. By 2007... Hamas kicked out Fatah. Mahmoud Abbas is still presumptively the leader of that country, doesn't do anything except get enormous payments every year and enriches himself. Hamas has run that country. They have, we hear in the news, and it's a true story, they have stolen billions of dollars from not just the United States, but from Israel and countries around the world, and put that into the infrastructure that has built their Hamas terror network. They have fired rockets indiscriminately into Israel for years. This just didn't start yesterday or on October 7th. October 7th was a serious ramp up because of the manifestation, the brutality, and the awful things that they did, the butchering of human beings, slaughtering them in front of their families. It's unbelievable. We haven't seen this certainly since the Asian Wars, and certainly back in World War II as well.
So why do you think the protesters that are saying free Palestine, free Gaza. They miss the fact that there was this brutal butchering.
So Sarah Carter was on Hannity the other night. She broadcast a story where she had gone to a pro-Hamas rally in New York City. And she asked some of the young students who were there, so do you think that Hamas is a terror organization? I thought what was interesting is the same sort of answers from these college students that we've been hearing about CRT, we've been hearing about ESG, DEI over the years. When Sarah Carter asked that question, you don't understand. You don't understand. You wouldn't understand. I can't tell you because you don't understand. They've been told to go out. They think that Israel is a colonizer. Okay, the only colonizers that exist are Hamas because they want to obliterate, not the Jewish state, they want to obliterate Jews. Once they get finished there, if they ever do, they start working on the other sects within the within Islam itself. And after that, they go off to the Christians. It's not about statehood. It's not about territory. It's strictly about submission or death.
Well, it's not that they would pick on the homosexuals or anything like that.
So a lady who I've known for probably 35 years, I run into her the other night, and she says to me that she talked with her friend who's got a LGBT blah, blah, blah kid at home. And the kid is like the serious pro-Hamas kind of a guy, right? And she told me the story about the mother who said, are you crazy? If you went into Gaza, if you went into Iran, if you went into Lebanon, you'd be stoned, you'd be murdered, you'd be killed for being who you are.
Thrown off a roof.
Or worse, thrown body parts, you know, et cetera, et cetera. When you look at the covenant, the Hamas covenant, it's not about life. It's not about liberty. It's not about democracy. It's all about death, and it's about death to the Jews. Their mission isn't fulfilled until there's the death of all the Jews in the world. Well, I got news for you. It's not going to happen now, and it's probably never going to happen. And they can shry all they want about the hospitals. We just heard it on CBS News. These hospitals that are they don't have water, they don't have power, they don't have medicine, etc. The Hamas headquarters are right underneath his hospitals. They have spent the hundreds of billions of dollars given, excuse me, hundreds of millions of dollars given to Gaza for infrastructure, for water, for sewers, for electrification, for new buildings, for administration, and so on. And they built these tunnels and so on. There's hundreds of miles of them underneath Gaza City.
And Gaza is not that big. The Gaza Strip is, what, 6 by 30 miles, 6 by 26 miles, something like that?
You're probably pretty close.
It's not that big. So,
What kind of a government, 75 years after the last battle in the War of Independence in 1948, what kind of a country still has people living in quote-unquote refugee camps? That's not a government. That's a persecution mob who wants to take advantage of people. And when you see these people crying in the streets, they should be crying because of Hamas, who's put them in this position. When you look all through the Middle East and into the enlightened countries, who are also Muslim, okay, the economies are robust, the people are working, the people have the ability to lead their lives and to live a good life, and all they want is a vacation. All they want is their car to start up in the morning. All they want is an ability to see their kids do better than what they do.
Do you think they're worried about Israel and Saudi Arabia coming to a good agreement?
I think that there's no escaping that the October 7th attacks happened when they did, when it appeared that Israel and Saudi Arabia were on the verge of making that agreement. But let's not forget, Hamas is of a different sect from the Saudis.
Sure.
They hate the Saudis. the Saudis don't like them very much. Now the Houthis, who are also aligned against Saudi Arabia, are now throwing rockets into the fray as well. We heard about, you know, from Captain Bob a few weeks ago about that with the USS Kearney.
So let's take that and come back to the United States and college campuses. There are huge protests, mainly in liberal cities.
Here in Tucson.
And we had it here in Tucson at the U of A. And by the way, they did not pull permits for that. And the college president, Robin, still let that take place.
I know.
If we tried that for the NRA, if we tried that for the Catholics.
Stop dead in your tracks.
Exactly. And yet they get to do it. It might be BLM. the Black Lives Matter group. The whole bit, no problem. Go ahead, do it. We'll give you a pass. Why?
Because there is a significant number of administrators and professors at the University of Arizona who are in agreement. There probably were 200 of them in this march the other day. There was close to 1,000 protesters out there marching in front of the U of A campus. And about 200 of them were teachers, and they interviewed some of them on TV, and it's astonishing to hear the sorts of things that they say in those interviews. You know, how Israel should be wiped out, how Israel's the oppressor. All Israel wants to be is left the hell alone. And if you want to come to Israel, okay, you have greater rights as a Muslim Arab citizen than you do in any of the Arab countries throughout the entire region.
So I haven't been to Israel yet. I'm looking forward to going. Talk about, so we've got Muslims living and working in Israel.
Right.
We've got Palestinians living and working in Israel.
Mainly working, not as much living,
okay.
but some do.
Okay. And they don't seem to have any problem. Or do they?
Well, okay, so we talked, I think, last week or the week before about the work permits that had been allowed, both going back to the Gantz-Lapid joint government, going back now about 3 or 4 years. But those work permits have increased even under Netanyahu's administration as well. So there were some mistakes made there, because some of these individuals who came in under the premise of workers have used their period of time in Israel as intelligence gatherers, because you know, with the documents that were found on some of the terrorists on October 7th, they had minute information, infrastructure, locations, and so on, that you couldn't have had if you just were in Gaza.
We've got 2 minutes and 30 seconds left. In your view, how does this end?
Well, the war is going to go on for a while, and it's going to be pretty ugly. It's going to continue to be pretty ugly. Israel has said that they are going to handle a civil administration for as long as it takes to develop security. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that they understand the end game of all this. It's still a work in progress. Colin Powell, you know, if you broke it, you got to fix it. Well, there's going to be a lot of fixing. There'll be hundreds of millions of dollars that are spent rebuilding the infrastructure and restoring Gaza to what it was before. And if I can, I just want to say something before we end today. Frank Borman, a great American, Apollo 8 astronaut, and Gemini 7 astronaut, died at age 95 earlier this week. He grew up in Tucson, went to Tucson High School, and was a product of schools here. A great American. He lived a great life, and just a great American.
Absolutely.
And he came from here in Tucson, Arizona.
We got a minute and 20 seconds. Talk about the elections.
Well, somebody asked me the question yesterday, so what does the election mean? And I said to that person that, number one, not enough Republicans showed up because they think that there was no way to win the election. And that might be so. But between Republicans not showing up and independents not showing up, there was only 20.7% of all the qualified voters in city of Tucson who showed up to vote in this city council election. Right now, there is no way for a Republican to win. Present day, a Republican is incapable of winning any elected office inside the city of Tucson.
Because we don't have people showing up.
We don't have people showing up, and there just aren't enough of us. There's lots of independents who probably lean to the right, but there's not enough people who apparently are fed up with all of the stuff going on in the world.
Bruce, we got a break. We're coming to the end. Thanks again to all our great guests today, former A-10 pilot King Campbell, Onita Davis, U.S. House member Eli Crane, and retired Army warfighter Lieutenant Colonel Willis Lee. Tune in next week when we have another great show featuring Senator Gail Griffin on Arizona water issues, Voices of the West hosts Bunker DeFrance and Harry Alexander. We'll see you again in 166 hours.
Jamie Kipper and her father, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal. What are they going to see when they come through the gates?
So when they come on in, they'll see our building up front. People have free rein to then go out and look in the yard. So it's not a typical scrapyard with a ton of big machinery. We have a couple of forklifts around, but that's about it just to help move material. So when you come in, it's all organized by material, whether it's square tubing, angle iron, roofing, and then there is a pile in the back, which is still organized and easy to get through, but that's stuff that comes over from the scrap. So we're unique in that we get stuff in from the scrap, which a lot of artists and people will like or reuse, whether it's a sink that someone needs for their house. We sell literally anything made of metal.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Let's see. Butterball turkey, stuffing mix, mashed potatoes, gravy, butter, cranberry sauce. What else?
Dad said we need a new turkey baster.
Okay, that's the next aisle. This car pulled to the right.
Why don't we take it to Perfection Auto Works? They fixed our car when it did that.
They don't work on shopping carts, and it's only one aisle over. So what are you, a commercial?
As a matter of fact, I am.
You just ran over Mr. Whipple.
This is Mike Emery at Perfection Auto Works. Our free 26-point inspection makes most car troubles a distant memory, as long as you just do the ordinary maintenance. Perfection Auto Works can handle all of your auto or truck repairs. 323-8650 or at perfectionautoworks.com. 323-8650. Hey, Whipple, quit squeezing that Charmin.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.